Hi there. Come up on the porch. We're just sitting here watching it rain and talking about Louisiana.
I'm Brittany.
And I'm Steve Payne.
And this is the Louisiana Anthology Podcast, episode 408 for March 13th, 2020.
Welcome back.
Today we talked to Ron McFarland about his book on Evangeline. Part one of our chat with him. Generations of readers have now accepted Henry Wadsworth Longfellow's call to join his heroine Evangeline. That's a big deal. Ron has written a book entitled The Long Life of Evangeline, A History of the Longfellow Poem in Print, an Adaptation and in Popular Culture. So we were really excited about this because we got to talk about the response to Evangeline, which has always interested me, especially in Louisiana, but, you know, all over the both English-speaking and French-speaking world. It was quickly translated. So we look forward to starting our chat with Ron in a minute. But first, this week in Louisiana history.
So this week in Louisiana history, we go back to New Orleans. This is March 13, 1815. General Andrew Jackson declares the end of martial law in New Orleans at the end of the War of 1812. Of course, this is right after the Battle of New Orleans.
Yeah, you know, the battle was on what, January 7th or 8th?
Right. I was going to say, the first week or so of January, yeah.
Yeah, and the British did not renew their attack, but they didn't leave right away either. It took them a while to sail away, and so he maintained martial law. And of course,
they had a good reason to. I just found this out this week. There were those forts down below the city, down the river, and one was Fort St. Philip, maybe. But anyway, there was one, you know, southeast of the city, I guess, and that one is. It's not inaccessible, but at least it is by road. I mean, the only way to get to it is by boat, or I guess, you know, you could fly in with a helicopter or a seaplane or something like that. But anyway, that thing, I think, was shelled. That one or one of the other sister forts was shelled by the British after the main battle. I didn't know it, but they subjected it to a cannonade after the battle. And I guess I don't know if it was out of revenge or if they actually thought they were going to take it or what, but they, you know, attacked it, you know, made a maritime attack from their own ships, in other words.
And well, he was determined not to relax his vigilance while they were still about. So he maintained martial law until March 13, 1815. So the battle the battle was over, but the war was not over.
Mm-hmm.
Now for this week in New Orleans history, born on March 13, 1901 in Plaquemine Parish, Andrew Morgan played clarinet with the Imperial Band in the mid-1920s, then joined his brother Isaac Morgan's band in 1925. And been a lot of, you know, songs that were famous at the time. Now for this week in Louisiana.
Oh, a site that we visited. So this week
in Louisiana. That's it. We've got a podcast from there.
Yeah, we honor the Los Adias State Historic Site. At this 300-year-old site that was once the capital of Texas, you'll get an up-close look at battles waged between two global superpowers. To get an idea of Los Adias Historic Site's importance, it helps to go back, way back, to the earliest days of European settlement in Louisiana. In 1716, New Spain stretched from present-day southern Mexico to California. Northwest Louisiana was a sparsely populated outpost then, which was disputed territory claimed by France. Thanks to the founding of Natchitoches in 1714 by a French Canadian named Saint-Denis, whose story is told at Fort Saint-Jean-Baptiste State Historic Site, Spain decided to send troops there, this is to Los Adias, building their own fort and missions within just a few miles of Natchitoches, and naming one mission Presidio Nuestra Señora del Pilar de Los Adias. I hope I didn't butcher that too badly. And we have
sounded good to me.
We've been down there, so. In fact, we met your friend Leslie and I think one of her students, didn't we, down there?
Yeah, they drove up and we took the tour and interviewed the docent or who, you know, the guy that was running the place. And they don't have any buildings from the period, but they have, like markers that mark mm-hmm. out the shapes of the buildings.
Yeah, so they know where they were because of the mm-hmm. archaeological record and archival record both. And they have a little museum. And if the listeners are interested, it's out near Robeline, you know, present-day Robeline. So it's southwest of Natchitoches, I guess.
Port St. Denis in Natchitoches was where the, or was it St. Jean Baptiste? I think that's it. In Natchitoches was where the French watched the Spanish, and this fort was where the Spanish watched the French.
And it's a great site, wouldn't you say? I mean, it's one of the mm-hmm. more interesting sites we visited because it really cries out for a replica fort like the one at Natchitoches. You know, unfortunately, they don't have one. But
what's really interesting to me is that the folks who live there now are descended from those people. You know, people in Louisiana are very local, and they don't like to move. So there's a mixture of Spanish and French and Choctaw and Apache. You know, they brought up Apaches, the Spanish did, and they mixed with the Choctaw. So it was quite a meeting of the cultures right there.
It bears out what we keep saying. Louisiana was multicultural before the Europeans ever came in, or as the Europeans came in, I should say.
Right.
But you had a lot of different native groups, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, now for this week's postcard from Louisiana, I listened to Demi Urge play on the levee just right across from Jackson Square by the Mississippi River.
Original content. Also, we have jogging suits and shoes. We have our own shoe line. You know, we're going to get right back at you with this hot music. And please, thank you for all your donations and continue to support.
Thank you.
This is an episode I've been looking forward to because you've written a book about evangelism. Would you tell our folks the name of the book and where they can buy it?
It's called The Long Life of Evangelism. And it's got a subtitle, which is probably too long in its own right. It's A History of the Longfellow Poem in Print, in Adaptation, and in Popular Culture.
Right, and that is, you're the guy to go to for a lot of the questions I had. Last guy who was doing more of a source analysis. Tim Bartel, you're probably familiar with him. He wrote about Evangeline and the influence on the patristics on Longfellow. And then I was asking him all these questions, and I didn't look that way. Well, why don't you start off by telling us where you're from and where you went to school and how you got interested in evangelism?
Well, okay. Your voice is breaking up a little bit, but I'm hoping mine is coming through okay at your end, is it?
Yours sounds good.
Let's hope
it holds up.
Okay, I was born in Ohio, moved to Florida when I was just through second grade, so I grew up in Florida and went to Florida State, got my bachelor's and master's there. Then I taught a couple of years at Sam Houston State in Huntsville, Texas, and went on to the University of Illinois for my doctorate. I was supposed to be a 17th century British Lit specialist, and then came out to the University of Idaho, and I just retired a couple of years ago after almost 50 years of teaching at the University of Idaho English Department.
Oh, my goodness.
And I got into evangeline probably the way most people of my generation, or maybe more likely my parents' or grandparents' generation, by running into it in the eighth grade when I had a teacher in eighth grade who was his special interest was Victorian poetry and all, and he liked to have us memorize chunks of poems and so forth. He was fond of Tennyson and Browning and so forth. But he was also and Swinburne. And he was also fond of Longfellow. And so we all memorized. This is the forest primeval, the murmuring pines and the hemlocks, spirited
right.
green and distinct in the twilight and all that. So you know we did a lot of poetry memorization. You know it's a funny thing that the first thing we memorized in his class, and this is Cocoa, Florida. 1954, 55, thereabouts, we memorized the first two stanzas of Dixie, and not to sing it, but to say it as a poem, the first two stanzas of Dixie, and the next thing we memorized was Lee's farewell address to the Army of Northern Virginia.
Oh, my.
4 years of arduous service marked by unsurpassed courage and fortitude and so forth. So it was a very different kind of world. He had a little plastic heart-shaped flag holder with a Confederate flag. This is before anything remotely like integration, of course. And he was a great teacher. This guy was a super teacher, probably the most influential teacher of my life, although his politics, I think, never especially influenced me.
Right.
But yeah, I got into evangelism then, and I forgot all about it. And then years ago, years after that, when I was prowling through used bookstores and that sort of thing, I came across one of those 1890s editions of Evangeline, and it cost like a buck or two, and it had lots of the illustrations from different sources.
Oh, yes. Was it one of the study editions that had all the, notes in it, or was it just more of a straightforward?
It had footnotes, which was good. It had an elaborate introduction with the poet's life.
Right.
And commentary on the meter, and that kind of stuff, so... it got me into it some ways. And then, I started collecting for whatever reason, I guess because I was kind of a collector then, I started collecting editions of Evangeline that I would pick up at used bookstores.
And for our listeners, there are some beautifully illustrated editions of Evangeline out there, from 100 years ago.
Oh, yeah. I think that was probably maybe my favorite element when it came to doing the research was the chapter on Evangeline Illustrated and the
oh my God.
Pen drawings, and they're fascinating, and some of the illustrations are just gorgeous. I mean, it was a great age of book illustration. I mean, and I'm speaking here of the 1880s and through the early 20th century, but it was wonderful stuff. I mean, and by sometimes really noted illustrators.
Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry. I think we're getting a little bit of signal breaking up. I was just saying, go ahead.
Oh, I was just talking about the early illustrators, the illustrators of the 1880s and 90s, and really from even earlier, but people like Howard Chandler Christie, F.O.C. Darley, these people that they're really works of art. And it's interesting. It was interesting to me how differently Evangeline was seen as a character, as a woman, in her portrayal, that sometimes she's seen as remarkably, there's an 1853 Gilbert thing shows her in very much sort of Normandy costume.
Right.
And then later on, if you get into, say, the images of her that show up in 1909 or thereabouts, Howard Chandler Christie, she looks, downright sexy, actually. It's kind of neat. I mean, she's the frontispiece with his 1905 illustration, she's really a woman to be reckoned with. I mean, a womanly woman.
right.
So I was interested in that, and then I started to get into it too. I got interested in the annotated school editions. What was being taught when Evangeline was being forced down the maws of America's school children, which. You have to go back to probably your grandparent or great-grandparents' days when it was the standard eighth grade reading. It was the last, and it was back when my grandfather on my mother's side was not a high school grad. He worked in the coal mines and so forth in eastern Ohio, and he went to school through the eighth grade, which was typical back then. And so the last significant literary work you read in the eighth grade was Evangeline. That was the first really important long American poem. On a long subject series, American Poem, a long subject, was Evangeline.
What is your theory about what happened to Evangeline? Why don't we read it? Because I'm just slightly behind you. I grew up in school in the 60s. In Louisiana, 64 to 94, I was in school, either K through 12 or 1 through 12, in college and grad school and, the drill, but never read Evangeline, never read anything about Louisiana, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, it was kicked out. I suppose you could say that it was one of the prices paid of the 60s and so forth. It was the last time it was really prominent in the canon was probably in the 1950s.
Right.
About the time I got it in the eighth grade. That was probably about it. And you might say that part of the radicalism of the 60s put it out to pasture. And also maybe what I think sometimes people might call something like the death of sentiment. It's very much a sentimental poem.
Oh, yeah.
And if you can't deal with sentimentality, if you decide that sentimentality itself is somehow reprehensible and a sign of weakness and so forth, both male and female in this regard, then, it's hard to find a place for it. And at the same time, it's also a very didactic poem. And so if you decide that you don't want the poem to be preachy in any sense, it's hard to avoid the fact that it was. It is a kind of that kind of poem. So the
yeah.
amazing, and to me, in some ways, although as a poet and writer myself, and as a teacher, I think one of the first poets that really grabbed me was John Donne, and you couldn't find a poet much less like Longfellow than John Donne, 17th century. And so, it's striking to me that I was actually taken with this poem, but I was fascinated with the phenomenon of it actually. And with all the implications, and when I got into the research on it, I found all kinds of interesting stuff, you know.
Right.
But I was interested in its decline from the canon. I was interested in the fact that it no longer spoke to us, so to speak.
Well, we have, Stephen and I, have an open agenda of wedging it back, at least in the Louisiana canon, like we're trying to post. We've got the book posted, so you can read it for free online, but we're also trying to put up lesson plans so that varied teachers will be able to download them and use them, you know, as they see fit. But, yes, you know, a few people, it seems to be more of a homeschool phenomenon, kids in Louisiana reading it, because their parents are in the homeschool movement, and they focus a lot on the classics. But far as reading it in a regular public school, parochial school, charter school, it doesn't happen that much in Louisiana.
No, I can see, and it probably doesn't happen that much throughout the country anymore. You know, you might almost say it's like a defrocked text.
Right.
it had been a kind of high priest of a certain sort, but I'm interested in elements of it. I'm interested in the historic elements, and I don't anticipate a revolution of enthusiasm for either Longfellow or Evangeline.
Right.
One of the interesting things I found when I did my research was how soon after his death, and even somewhat before his death, there was a kind of anti-Longfellow movement among serious literary scholars of the university sort, you know, that were already writing that he was trite or hackneyed or overly sentimental.
The Longfellow poem I had memorized as a kid was, "Under the spreading chestnut tree, the village smitty stands." That's
yes.
Sort of border on doggerel, you know. It's not
yeah.
one of those.
But even worse is the Psalm of Life, "Tell Me Not in
Mournful Numbers." Oh, I memorized that one too. "Tell Me Not in Mournful Numbers. Life is but an empty dream." I could go
but
on.
But the thing that's remarkable about that is how much of that has woven itself into the language, how familiar all those lines are and so forth. And I suppose they're more familiar to someone of my generation than they are to yours or the next one following. So maybe they'll all be lost. But
I had a rather old-fashioned father who... I had a class in fourth grade where we had to memorize a poem and have to declaim every week. And I was doing some bad poetry until the teacher, you know, like the purple cow or something.
Good.
Teacher sent a note home to my dad, and he got down the classic American, you know. He was a Baptist preacher. He knew his poetry about as well as he knew his Bible. I memorized some really good poems in fourth grade. and before I went to school and gave my recitation, I would have to stand in the film and give my recitation. I think I was more nervous about that than I was the school situation. But anyway, I learned some poems that I, at 62 years of age, still remember today, you know. And I'm looking back at kids for the last several generations and wondering, it's not just that we let Evangeline go. Are they memorizing anything but Ralph?
yeah, true. I mean, it's a kind of a lost art. And for a number of years here at Moscow High, one of the teachers sponsored a kind of, there's a national group that does a poetry sort of memorization thing. And for several years, I was one of the judges of student recitations, and it was amazing how high school students could still do memorization and really eloquent deliveries of poems. And usually they had to do, as I recall, I think they had to do three poems. And one poem would be typically a traditional poem, you know, like Keats or Longfellow or something like that. And then the other two would be modern, and modern free verse poems, unrhymed, no particular meter, which made them difficult to memorize, and they were wonderful at it. There would be local contests at the high schools, and then they would go to state down in Boise, and the winners at the various state projects would go to Washington, D.C. for a national competition. And this all was really active for a number of years and only stopped about 4 or 5 years ago when that particular teacher retired. So.
Yeah, I no longer, well, I don't have students stand up for a site, but I have them memorize 20 lines of poem, you know, a poem for the essay exam, just so they'll, I say, look, when you go home at Thanksgiving, I want you to be able to show your family that you actually learned something at school.
And if you have it by heart, they'll actually believe it.
That's it. If they can recite, then, well, that's a great poem.
If they can memorize song lyrics, they can memorize a poem.
Oh, yeah.
Well, right, yeah.
And
there is
a private school. I don't remember the name of it. It's been a couple of years since I watched this stuff. But, they have all their students memorize Horatio at the Bridge by Macaulay. I can't remember exactly his name, but I wasn't planning to talk about it. But anyway, they, you know, cut it together and show the students the better ones reciting the poem. You can find it on YouTube. And I would like someday for there to be a similar thing for Evangel, you know, just students getting up and reciting that and really YouTube. So do you think part of the reason that Evangel specifically fell out was changing the ideals about the roles of women? Like the idea of a woman who spends her life searching for a man, does that fit in the modern feminist framework?
Well, it should have. I always kind of thinking when I wrote this book, I wanted to try to speak to the fact that, to me, it should be one of the early examples of a feminist and a woman who actually takes agency into her own
hand,
is what the feminist movement should be all about. I mean, and she, in a reversal of the Aeneid in some ways, where the man goes out in search of his destiny, this woman goes out in search, and she doesn't give up, and she goes through the wilds pretty much alone a good portion of the time.
Uh-huh.
And
she's badass, right?
She's in the wilds of the West and the North Woods and all this sort of thing. She's running around savage Indian tribes. And
right.
A remarkable character.
And normally it is a guy who is the hero of an epic.
Sure.
I think the closest precedent for her would be Cupid and Psyche. Are you familiar with that? Apuleius, and Psyche goes in search of Cupid. But Psyche obviously is more of an allegory, right? Okay, I have a pet.
Or did you ever find when you were writing your book that he might have had an actual historical model in mind when he created that character?
Composite? Yeah, he gets the idea for it out of Nathaniel Hawthorne. Nathaniel Hawthorne is told by a Reverend Connolly, and so he supposedly there is supposedly an original, original source for it in the expulsion from Acadia, or essentially, which is like the expulsion from Eden or something like that.
Right.
It's easy to mythologize the thing, but yeah, there's supposed to be an original story, and probably what it is some sort of a collective of different kinds of story, different stories of couples that were split up and that in the derangement, you know, that occurred in Nova Scotia. So,
well, just to let our folks know, the word Acadia.
Sorry, lost you on that one. You still there?
Hey, Bruce.
Hey.
Bruce?
I lost you in the breakup of the speech there.
Bruce. He may have to call us back. Let's see if he'll come back in a second.
Oh, okay.
Bruce? Let's see, he just texted me, I think.
That was something else. Something else on my smartphone, and it was not Bruce.
What's Bruce's number? Do you know it?
Yes, 805-2326 or 318-805-2326, but he'll have to – they just come through that hurricane down there, and he'll have
to – Yeah, he said – I was watching that Atlanta game last night. I couldn't believe how much – well, Atlanta, North Carolina, you know, against the Carolina, that was – at the NFL game, which is pouring the entire time. So that was the part of that hurricane.
Yeah, it was – he had to go to a hotel somewhere else. I don't know if it was in Battery or, you know, where, but he had to go somewhere else in order to be able to do some recording last night – or yesterday and last night. And
yeah, my impression, he's still there, I think, so. So should I call him, do you think, or should I just hang up and let him call me again?
Yeah, you know what? We have both of us ought to hang up and let him call us back because it could be, like I said, obviously he's lost his signal, but he'll have to patch us both in through that, paper call.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll hang up.
Yeah, let's just... He's got to patch us both in.
I am in the... aftermath of Hurricane Zeta, and phone's not really working well. I appreciate you hanging with us, Ron. The question I was asking was that I had read the article that I read about it before, and the guy was
still not getting through. Bruce?
Hey, Bruce.
So I guess we should hang up again, huh?
We may have to.
Maybe have to discontinue the call, you know, in another week or something, or another Friday.
Like I said, last night he was, when we were trying to do some recording, an intro and an outro for the episode that we'll post tonight or early tomorrow morning. And
y'all are there.
You there? Okay,
yes.
Good.
Is Ron there?
Yeah, you faded back in.
Yeah,
good.
Do you think we should continue it, or should we wait another week or something?
Let's see. We're doing next week. Hopefully the gods of... Yeah, we're free next week if you want to do it at the same time next Friday.
We could do that.
Okay.
I mean, I don't see why not.
Definitely not tomorrow because we've got an interview on Halloween afternoon of all time with a chef.
And next Friday we could catch something like Hurricane Ida. I think that comes after Zeta, doesn't it?
I know, right?
Yeah.
Zeta, whatever.
Maybe they'll have it put back together by then. Well, thank you so much, Ron. And I think what we got was usable, so we'll just pick up where we left off.
Good.
Write your question down so you don't forget it between now and next week.
Well, it was just about the naming of Acadia as the Eden on Earth and as a way of trying to encourage people to immigrate. So, anyway, thank you, Ron. I'm so sorry that this happened yet again.
I can't hold you responsible for hurricanes, I don't think.
I think I angered the gods. Somehow. Oh my goodness, we had an interview about voodoo and Marie Laveau a couple of weeks ago.
Well, you were looking for it then.
Yeah, she was the first week. She wasn't able to come on because she had a horrible backache. So I was like, are there any dolls with pins in them around your? You know, maybe better look and burn some sage or something.
Evangeline doll with pins in it. This is a story here. I think that's probably.
I know.
Used to be able to get those down there.
I bet you still could. I mean,
but you could too. One thing I was going to get when I went down there and went to do, you know, I was doing Bayou Teche and I was at St. Martinville and all that. I was going to get myself an Evangeline doll and somehow never got around to it.
Oh, man.
Big regret of mine.
You should look around online. You probably can find one.
Yeah,
with the wooden shoes and all that, we need to talk about the wooden shoes when you come back on.
I've
never heard an explanation about that. Okay, thank you. Well, if it's good, we'll do this at the same time next week.
Okay, we'll do it.
Thank you so much, Ron. This has been great
nice
so far.
Nice talking to you so far, Bruce and Steve.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye.
Okay, it's Bruce. We're back a week later.
hurricane, the last hurricane is a little bit further behind us. Cell service is a little bit better, and the next hurricane hasn't gotten here yet, so we're sitting pretty for a minute. Welcome back, Ron. Thanks for rescheduling because the phone service is so bad last week. I don't know. We'll try to use as much of it as we can, but we'll kind of reboot from here if that's okay.
Sure.
And you were going to start off with a few comments that you had about Evangeline, so why don't we just get to it?
Okay, yeah. One of the questions about Evangeline, which I think was of interest in some ways, is how it was at one time a dominant player in the canon of American literature, widely in public school, and so forth. And the question was, why did it slip away, and how did it slip away? And one of my initial responses was that the 19th century, the mid-19th century, when this poem came out, this sort of pocket epic or idyll, I-D-Y-L-L, idyll, as opposed to I-D-L-E, which would be another story altogether, how that thing sort of slipped away. And my part of my point at the time was that it was the great age of poetry to the extent that there's ever been one in the United States and maybe even throughout the European world anyhow, that was a great period of poetry. And so Evangeline had a special advantage at that particular time. It was before the complete domination, perhaps, of fiction, the novel, and all that. Even though, of course, it's in the midst of the time of Melville and Hawthorne and Poe and so forth. So anyhow, but another thing is that it was also a didactic poem, a poem of considerable sentiment and so forth, and that some of the negative response to the poem that came out even in the 1880s following Longfellow's death had to do with the notion that its value system, its morals, its ethics, and so forth were sort of old-fashioned, no longer relevant and so forth. And so I was going to try to say a word or two about that as I see it from the in my book, and this, if you're looking at the book, it would be page 57.
Okay, good.
There's a chapter called The Contexts of Longfellow's Evangeline. And I wrote here, it's a didactic poem, and right away, that's one reason why it's no longer in the canon, because we're not as accustomed or interested in the didactic poem today as the country was, the world was, in the middle of the 19th century. And it's also a poem of sentimentality. And it's also true that mid-19th century, one thinks of Dickens' novels, for example, was a great age of sentiment. And so anyhow, the didactic poem in which the reader is offered explicit moral and ethical lessons, and the ones in this poem are four, the four basic ones anyhow. Affection or love is never wasted, no matter how hopeless the circumstances may seem. Two, one should endure suffering silently and patiently, that is to say, stoically. Stoically somehow sounds better than silently or patiently.
Right. Ties it into the idea.
Three, the good, the upright, or virtuous life requires self-abnegation and devotion to the welfare of others. And four, justice does not necessarily equate with a happy ending. And then I suggest, now it's, all these seem very old-fashioned, potentially very old-fashioned, and yet it would be hard to sort of argue against them. And I say in the book, if these values seem quaint or outmoded, perhaps one might consider the alternative. One, love is only a fine name for lust, as opposed to affection or love is never wasted. Two, avoid pain and suffering and seek pleasure at all costs, which I call neo-Epicureanism, as opposed to one should endure suffering silently and stoically. Three, the good life involves self-indulgence and disregard of others. Sounds like certain responses to the pandemic, in fact, especially out here.
Right.
And four, justice implies that everyone lives happily ever after, as opposed to the notion that justice does not necessarily equate with a happy, I might say, Hallmark ending. We get, in fact, on my limited television cable, we get no fewer than three Hallmark channels. So I'm constantly reminded by Hallmark that, in fact, justice is supposed to be implied that everyone lives happily ever after. So this is not ultimately a Hallmark poem, really. So that's part of what I wanted to say, just as a point of departure, and in response, really, to the notion that somehow the moral or thematic burden of this poem is somehow outmoded or, Pollyanna-like, sentimental or even vulnerable in a way. So anyhow, I wanted to start off with that kind of statement.
I like that. And, we've seen as our values shift as a culture, kind of the four anti-values that you mentioned have come to be ascendant in America. So I can see why in our current state, Evangeline wouldn't be particularly cool, but she might be more necessary than ever.
Yeah.
We've got to have something to call people back to some kind of, civic virtue, it ties in with her personal virtue, I think, in Tennyson. Longfellow. So I had a question. It was my kind of personal pet theory, and I expected to find a lot on it, and I found very, very little, which is Stephen and I sat in on our favorite professor's last quarter at Tech when he taught epics, and he said that, he kind of have a pretty simple schema. The Iliad is about conflict, and its hero is Achilles, and his primary characteristic is maenas, which is anger, and then the Odyssey is the quest to return home, and its hero is Odysseus, who's Polytropos, twisty, kind of tricky. And then you have the Aeneid, which books 1 through 6 are like a little odyssey, and books 7 through 12, books 1 through, 1 through 6 are like a little odyssey, as they search the Mediterranean for their new place. And they see some of the same things Odysseus saw. And then 7 through 12 is about conflict on the peninsula, replicating the Trojan War right down to Aeneas stealing some other guy's girl, And
killing Charles.
So when I read this, it just kind of, I was woefully late reading Evangeline. When I did get around to reading it after getting in that class, it just leaped out at me that sections 1 through 5, I want to call them books, are about the conflict in Grand Prix in Acadia. And then 5, 6 through 10 are a replication of the wanderings of the Odyssey. In the wanderings of books 1 through 6. But I haven't been able to find anybody that talked about that. So I wanted to ask somebody who's an actual expert on it, what do you think about that thesis? Like, does it seem to be reasonable to you, or am I just imposing something that's not there?
Well, if you are, then so am I, because I mentioned on page, I'll refer to myself on page 176, reference to Aeneas and the quest, sort of motif.
Yeah.
I asked on this page, I said, Jacques M. Chevalier and others have demonstrated we also sense something deeply archetypal when we read the poem. That's partly what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But a lost paradise, a wandering in the wilderness, an exile, and whether Longfellow's idealized portrait of Acadia, and of course it does suggest Arcadia, the idealized place that which we see in the first five books of the, or cantos of the poem, connects remotely with the place as it actually was in the mid-18th century, does not seem relevant. Longfellow does not attempt to recreate historical events except as indicated in the chapters above, which involve the dérangement, as the as French Canadians, as they wanted to sort of placidly put it, this sort of disarrangement and a derangement. Anyhow, but Longfellow does not attempt to that and so forth. Does the dispersal of the Acadians more closely resemble Hebrew Exodus under Moses,
mm-hmm.
or the wanderings of the Trojans under Aeneas? Does Evangeline appear more like Eve or the Virgin Mary, the Mater Dolorosa, the Shulamite woman of the Song of Solomon, Esther, Ruth, she may well involve all of those biblical types. But it was only a kind of a temporary observation about the Aeneid. But I really felt that she was a sort of a female Aeneas type, and yes, that it deserved to be sort of followed through and thought out.
Aeneas' heroic quality, rather than anger or trickiness, is pious. He's pious Aeneas, the loyal, the pious, and that's very much Evangeline too. She seems like a female version of Aeneas to me.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. And she,
can you translate that as faithful, the pious verse?
And it often is.
I'm thinking
often translated as pious.
In Christian imagery, particularly ancient Christian imagery, one of the most persistent representations of a Christian is, and she is not this, but it is the dog of all things, because the dog is always faithful.
Fides, right.
Yeah, and so...
Fido for a dog's name.
Right.
Yes, exactly. And so, I mean, she's the emblem of faithfulness, if you think about it in that regard, you know?
Yeah. But she also represents, I think, importantly, the values of compassion. She's a compassionate...
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that's, one of those virtues that tends to be overlooked, except, for example, in recent presidential elections, suddenly that which Mr. Trump seems not to have great deal of, which Mr. Biden at least attempts to associate himself with, is the
right.
And it's something we actually do value, as it turns out. But it's not a...
If ever so slightly more than we like the bully and the swaggering.
Well, the problem with compassion is it's not a manly virtue, you know. It's not
right.
A good Achilles type.
Or it's not anymore. I don't know if it ever was, but it's definitely out of style now.
Oh, yeah. It's actively despised in certain quarters, right? I mean, the idea of
that's true.
The literal definition of it being, you know, suffering alongside somebody else. I mean, it's just, how dare you? You know, I mean, it's despised.
Yeah.
They associate, as an example, they associate Trump with a John Wayne figure. Even Wayne, in his films, as stoic as he was, his character would oftentimes show compassion. I mean, and then he would go off and maybe cry off camera, whatever. But I mean, you know.
Oh, I don't think that he's ever cried, right?
No, but I'm just saying he would. His character would occasionally show compassion. I mean, particularly if you see that film Three Godfathers, where they're taking that baby in that trek across the desert.
And there's
other examples too. But I'm just saying he's got compassion.
Yeah, we see some of that in the Rooster Cogburn things, but also in the early ones, like she wore a yellow ribbon and
there's
a Fort Apache, something like that. You know, she's definitely got that element. And I think it was played on more earlier, in fact, in his career than it was later. Although in the last one, like the last gunfighter, whatever, you know, that's...
The Shootist! Yeah, I like that movie.
Yeah,
that's a great film, yeah.
So, I like that. I like that you pointed that out in the book. It makes me feel better about my observation, and I think part of the problem is not only is it out of style in the classroom, but because professors aren't teaching it, they're not writing about it either. You know, we tend to, you know, like I started teaching Evangeline in my American Lit classes several years ago. You know, because I figured out that I had nothing from Louisiana in my whole syllabus. I think I first got in a little Chopin and then George Washington Cable, but probably early on I put in Evangeline too, and that's when, you know, I started thinking seriously about it. I started teaching it.
So, Louisiana becomes sort of like Italy or Italia or eventually the founding place of Rome, at least potentially so. And that's one of the strange things about this poem is that the first five books are so idyllic. We know that the derangement, the expulsion, which is really a kind of ethnic cleansing after all, version of it, happens in 1755. We know that Evangeline is 17 at the time, so we know that she was born in 1738. It's amazing how much stuff you know, so to speak, about Evangeline. So the first five books are so nicely knit as an idol and so forth, and she has very little to say. And And suddenly, the second, part two, the next five cantos, are really kind of, I found them kind of relentless, and there's a, you're led to believe that, of course, she is going to go the way of Aeneas. She is going to discover Gabriel, and she's going to settle down in Louisiana. That first night reading the poem, you know, if you're uninfluenced by an introduction or a commentary on the poem, you just read it, and you read into part two, and things are really interesting. A lot of the descriptive language is powerful, you know, the mockingbird here and so forth, and you realize, of course, that Louisiana at the time was under Spanish domination, and thus we have the image of Basil the blacksmith, kind of a, you know, Mexican cowboy with a big sombrero or something like that, especially obvious in the illustrated versions. And, you know, it goes to a dais, and so it's appropriately historically Spanish at this moment, but this is the establishment of the Cajun New World, you know, and they're
yeah.
their world, and it's so much like being kicked out of Troy, and so, but this thing is almost annoying about Longfellow. It's painful, I guess, about it, and makes the book somehow, the poem, relentless and inexorable, this sense that, yes, it's going to happen, she's going to meet Gabriel, they're going to establish it. No, it doesn't happen. Next thing you know, you're in the North Woods, and it ends up in Philadelphia at the yellow fever epidemic.
Well, except, of course, George Voorhees rewrote the story, so it had the proper ending under the oak tree in Bayou Teche, you know, by Bayou Teche.
I
wanted
to when I was doing research, and I went down to Teche Bayou and had to sit under the Evangeline Oak, which is, I don't know which generation of Evangeline Oak it actually is. It ain't the original one, though.
Well,
you just mentioned a technique that he used that's pretty brilliant. It's the idea of the plot twist.
Yeah.
You know, the narrative doesn't go in the expected direction. It goes off on some wild. It's not a tangent at all. I mean, it is integral to the plot, but yet it is a sort of a reordering of things, and it's completely unexpected to the readers.
Yes,
and he uses that pretty brilliantly.
Yeah.
I'll just read a few lines about Louisiana in the poem. It's his introduction to Louisiana, which is kind of a new Acadia, which we indeed call Acadiana to this day. On the banks of the Teche are the towns of St. Mar and St. Martin. There the long wandering bride shall be given again to her bridegroom. There the long absent pastor regained his flock and his sheepfold. Beautiful is the land with the prairies and forests of fruit trees. Under the feet a garden of flowers and the bluest of heavens. Bending above and resting its dome on the walls of the forest, they who dwell there have named it the Eden of Louisiana. So Eden again, you know.
Then we get the Atchafalaya and all. No one knows how much. We do know that many a weary year had passed since the burning of Grand Pre. That we sit down, we know how many years. It's interesting, scholars do talk about it. The most common notion is that about 10 years have passed. She's a maiden. She's a maiden, and she's still young, and fair was she and young, and so forth. And so we know that. So if this is the case, then she's probably in her mid-20s here. It's funny how when you read the poem, you don't necessarily think of the explicit, you know, those things, but I'm enough of a historian type or enough of a memoir photographer to think, how old is she here? Well, she's
we've got to have our timelines. But also, he leads us, what you said about setting up an expectation, the bride will be restored to her bridegroom. You know, the first reading, we're expecting them to be reunited. And I wonder, like, Romeo and Juliet, straight up tragedy, right? This doesn't read quite like tragedy to me. And I'm not sure, maybe it's triumphant suffering or redemptive suffering. I don't know. What are your thoughts on that?
What is what?
You know, this being a tragedy, it doesn't seem like, you know, it's sad.
Yeah, but you're right. It's not a tragedy. I don't think it is.
Okay.
And it does work. I know it tended to be settled upon was an idol and so forth. And it has, in a certain respect, it has a certain kind of, quote, happy ending, unquote. I mean, they are eventually reunited.
Right, yes, and they get to say goodbye.
And she has, by this time, she's She's reinvented herself, would be the term we would use now for it.
If you're
the evangelist, she becomes a Sister of Mercy and so forth, and, you know.
Well, one of the most famous women in New Orleans history was an Irish woman who moved to the city with her husband and child. I think they moved to America, but not to New Orleans. But her husband and child both promptly died of yellow fever, and she kind of hooked up with the nuns locally, and but became a very, you know, successful businesswoman and used all that money to support the local orphan. And we have a statue of her hugging a couple of orphans. What was that woman's name, Stephen?
The name escapes me right now. Is she the one that becomes a baker in New Orleans?
Yes.
Oh,
she has the biggest bakery in New Orleans. Can't read or write, but she's sending her goods up the Mississippi River all through the middle of the country. So that idea of, okay, this avenue has closed, and she didn't, like, eventually, too, she didn't want to start over with some other guy. So what's
right.
plan B? Well, if you're Catholic, you've got a plan B. You can become a nun.
Yeah. And it's all consistent, because from the outset, she's been described as a faithful Roman Catholic and so forth.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
With Father Felician later on, with Jesuit priest and so forth, so she never loses contact with the church.
Right.
Well, could you characterize this? And if you look at, you know, different literary theorists talk about types of plots, could you characterize this as a combination of exile and return, maybe, but definitely a quest narrative, where she's in search of something, you know, herself, her higher meaning, or higher purpose, whatever. It's all about that quest.
Yeah, I think it's your Joseph Campbell book here about this time. You know, that, you know, she becomes a female of that type. She goes out into the unknown, comes back. She has changed, and she has an effect, an impact on the community, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
A simplified version of Joseph Campbell's quest motif.
So,
but yeah, I think it works very well.
It also seems to me that I know you worked on response to this, and there was a particular reaction in the Acadian diaspora, where young men and young women, I suppose, too, would, you know, it was quickly translated into French. These young guys would carry the book through the woods and memorize long passages. They grew up to form the Acadian identity movement, you know, pan-national, but also local. The Acadians became the Cadens, became the Cajuns.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like, had there been no Evangeline, there might be no Cajuns. They would just be other Creoles. Like, you know, we had people moving into South Louisiana all over.
Mm-hmm.
And if they were speaking French and Catholic, they were just lumped in with the rest of the Creoles. But this kind of separated them out so that they had their own identity. What did you learn about that? Like, again, I'm wondering if that's something real, or if I just kind of imagined it.
Well, I think she does create an identity, an identity for it. I can't imagine. I mean, there. I guess there would have. Would there have been Cajuns? I suppose they would have spoken that strange blend of French and English that I encountered when I was doing the research on this earlier on. I think it was like in the book came out more recently, but I think I did some of the research back in the 1980s. I remember going.
Oh, yeah, there were a lot more French speakers here then.
Yeah, and that was in the bayous, and I was listening at various bars where I've been listening from time to time. And, you know, sure enough, I was hearing chunks of it. It was kind of fascinating. And I even hit up a bar way off in the bayous. I took some kind of back route into Florida one time when I was teaching at Sam Houston State in Texas. And when I was getting married in Florida, I drove to the bayous, and I stopped at night at one of those taverns, you know, with Studevant stilts above the swampy waters and all.
Oh, my goodness. Those movies never end well, Ron.
Old people, young people, all dancing, the fiddle music, and people speaking Latin, English, and French. It was remarkable. And this was in the 60s, in the 1960s.
Wow.
I grew up down there in Baton Rouge, and it's not a Cajun city. It's like they say, you know, New Orleans is not Cajun either, but a lot of Cajuns have moved to both cities, you know, through the years to work or whatever. And I heard as a kid growing up down there that there were people, particularly when you get across the river, you know, west of the Mississippi River, out there where I had an aunt who was German. Her family were German Cajuns. They were those Germans that moved in and intermarried with the Cajuns over about 150, 200 years. And she had relatives who her, not her parents, but I guess her great-grandparents, no, her grandparents, I guess, didn't speak any English or spoke very little English. Her parents did, but her, you know, it was her grandparents were French speakers.
Yeah.
And that was common even through the 70s, you know, 70s and 80s when I was a kid.
Grandma still didn't speak English.
Yeah, I mean, I would hear those old-timers down there talking, and particularly we'd go out to West Baton Rouge Parish to visit my relatives, because my uncle was from North Louisiana, so his dialect was like mine and Bruce's, more or less, but my aunt's family, I mean, I'd hear those old-timers and her family, and their French accent was very pronounced.
Yeah.
And they would sometimes drift to Cajun French. They'd start speaking Cajun French. And, of course, I couldn't understand a word they were saying.
It's a real nice blend. And certain words like share, for example, show up. You know,
yeah.
Share. And then I remember I was at a bar one time and listening to a guy, and it was just, you know, it's somewhere off in the bayous, and some guy was at the counter saying something. Say, honey, I don't have no l'argent. You know,
uh-huh.
They put it that way. And I think he was trying to get himself a free drink, actually, but I don't know if I can't recall whether that worked. I remember just hearing it and think, yeah, there it is. And it's kind of a casual part of that language.
Well,
but I suppose it's fading now, so.
Yeah, they're trying to bring it back with these immersion schools and stuff, but I worry that what you need is the day-to-day of it, and we've lost that, and it may be too far gone. You know, we didn't do what Quebec did in the 60s and say, let's be bilingual. It would be a real advantage to Louisiana kid growing up in a global economy. You know, if every kid in Louisiana could speak French fluently when they graduated high school.
Yeah, Americans, no, they didn't want to do that.
No.
I remember, it reminds me of a student I had one time when I was teaching Sam Houston Stage. His father was a shrimper out of Galveston, went down there once with him for the blessing of the fleet.
Right.
And his father and mother spoke Italian and so forth, and he was embarrassed. The boy was embarrassed and that his English teacher in college was here and his parents were speaking Italian. I found it kind of charming.
Definitely.
And he was absolutely resisting. He was not about to learn Italian. And I had neighbors up here, as a matter of fact, whose parents were the husband and wife were Danish, and they wanted their daughter, their only child was a daughter, to speak Danish. Absolutely resisted that she would not, and that's the rule rather than the exceptions throughout the states.
Yeah, my sister
started speaking English as soon as possible and fade from it.
When my sister adopted an 11-year-old girl from Latvia, who, you know, basically an orphan, and she wanted her to keep her heritage, so she got her, like, a Russian-speaking tutor to come around every week and try to keep that language going, and I don't think she's speaking now. She's grown, and like, I mean, she talks American, you know? She's very much an American girl. And,
I love it, you know. And even, as a matter of fact, to take away any kind of accent that they might have sustained, which might or might not be kind of attractive. I'm writing a book on, written a book on Gary Soto, who's the probably maybe the number one Chicano writer, at least in terms of the volume of his works, which is over 70 for adults and children and all. He's from California. His parents were Mexicans, Mexican-American. He did not grow up in a Spanish-speaking household, essentially, so he had to learn Spanish, which he did. He's pretty much fluent in Spanish, but this was his own thing and something he did as an older person, not as a child.
Well, and there's a living, vibrant Spanish-speaking culture in America. There's a place to use it.
This guy's like 68, and so that that was not as cool when he was a high school kid.
Right.
Just Spanish. There you were. Now it's much more common for them to, I think, for the Spanish speakers to hold on to, the Latinx population to hold on to there.
There's a leveling kind of a process in this country where, particularly if you go to work for corporate America, and I'm thinking in right here more specifically in for example, mass media like TV or even internet broadcasting, and they want someone who can speak like this, and they want that Midwestern sort of dialect like you get in Nebraska and Iowa. And it's the best example, people used to say, if you want to hear it, listen to Johnny Carson. I mean, he was from Nebraska. And if you listen to Johnny Carson or anybody from that area.
David Letterman.
Letterman, yeah, he's from Indiana, I think. But anybody like that, that's the dialect you get, or the variety of English that you get. It's certainly not a local kind of a dialect that you would get in TV, unless if you're watching local news in a very small market where they might hire some locals, because otherwise you're not going to get that.
That's right. And that used to be the sort of standard for public, I mean, like CBS broadcasters and so forth.
Oh, right.
Dan Rather's a good example of that. Listen to Dan Rather's early broadcast when he was still back in Texas, and he was like this and like that, and, you know, those flat I phonemes or whatever, but they consciously try to sort of squeeze that out of those readers or out of those reporters.
I remember when I was teaching in Texas that there was a small dictionary of Texan. Then you say lack for like.
Yeah, exactly. Turn right at the light.
I say, thai. How are you doing, thai?
Nice.
Yeah, it's like a North Louisiana dialect. It's very similar, but turn right at the light, you know.
That's right.
So I wanted to get into some of the response to Evangeline, especially in Louisiana, since that's kind of our focus. So what did you learn about, like, Evangeline hits the presses. How did it become so big here? We talked a lot about why it went away, but it was huge. Stephen and I did one of our early podcasts on Evangeline, and we started off by going through all the Evangeline name stuff, or not all of it, just a little of it, looking through phone books. There's Evangeline nursery, there's Evangeline daycare, there's Evangeline school, there's Evangeline nursing home, there's Evangeline graveyard, there's Evangeline tire and lube, but, you know, it's just an Evangeline industrial complex here. So how did they react in Louisiana to this story? Because, you know, that it seems like sometimes literature creates its own reality. You've got this windswept field in Nova Scotia that people start showing up with their copies of Evangeline. Where's the church? Well, I don't have a church, you know, but I'll build one. And we'll put a statue in front of it. Yeah. And then tourists will come. So walk us through some of the, you know, reactions to Evangeline after the fact, like, you know, the way it impacted our culture and our economy.
Yeah, I think but, you know, one of the strange elements of it, a lot of people don't realize that, you know, basically Evangeline, the name itself, is created by Longfellow. He dreams up the name, creates it. Maybe you could associate it with evangel and with angels and all that.
Mm-hmm.
Right, it's from the Greek word for gospel. So
right.
It's not originally a French name, apparently.
Greek.
And it's thought to... that maybe little Eva out of Uncle Tom's Cabin, her full name is Evangeline, and that name is, even that name is associated, you know, follows out of, that Harry Beecher so means for that echo to occur, to think of the saint-like, if you will, Evangeline of Longfellow. That's probably a stretch, by the way, but anyhow, the poem itself becomes, you know, essentially a bestseller, and that's part of it right there that goes through these multiple editions in Longfellow's lifetime. And then I think really after, and that there are annotated editions early on and illustrated editions, sometimes beautifully illustrated editions going back to the 1860s and 70s that also help create or substantiate the myth somehow.
I love looking at those old books. I mean, it's just fun to look at old books.
Yeah, I have an old FOC Darley edition of the thing dating back to the 1860s or so. That's just great.
Oh, my goodness.
It's a really, the book itself is a kind of, I suppose now we might call it a coffee table book, actually. the size of it, for example, is the size of a coffee table book. But the prints are just remarkable, and they're artworks. I mean, it was in fact the great age of the illustrated book. And I'm thinking here, really from the 1860s into the into the early, say, 1920s, where you're looking at Joel Chandler Christie and so forth. These are remarkable sort of artists working here, and I was really happy that McFarland Press was able to handle that chapter, to reprint the various images so you see different kinds of art styles and all. But I think that has an important role to play in the development of Evangeline in the public consciousness, so to speak. But it's a little chapter I have called Evangeline Goes to School, which is a chapter that's...
Right.
I don't think it's very interesting in some ways, but it probably explains part of the establishment. It gets literary established to the extent that I think it's Barthes who says, Roland Barthes supposedly says, literature is what gets taught. And I thought, what an interesting... I've always thought that was an interesting sort of critical theorist. Hey, literature is what gets taught. Evangeline got taught. And it got taught big time between the 1880s and about 1960, thereabouts. And so you have all these annotated school editions, and I think that particular chapter that I wrote is not very interesting. Evangeline Goes to School, except it's kind of in a general way of sort of suggesting what sorts of things were being taught.
Well, and just by way of update, I think I mentioned last week that Stephen and I want to put Louisiana literature back in the classroom, and Evangeline is right at the center of that. I have a class right now. I've divided, split between grad students and seniors. I've divided them up into 4 weeks, and we're group one is doing week one of Evangeline unit, group two, week two. And I've given them I've told them where these books are, and most of them are online now. The study edition, and use this for your current lesson plan. So hopefully this stuff will be easily accessible to teachers down the road so that they can come to our site and find all this, and because they'll have a great historical introduction. They'll have a biography of Longfellow. They'll have footnotes. They'll have vocabulary. They'll have end notes. They'll have an index. These are just very good teaching editions of the poem, and we're trying to make these, and they're out there, but they're hard to find.
That's right.
And teachers, they're under the gun and just have so much time to work on it. So if it's here in a box ready to unpack and teach, I think it'll help put even, at least it'll be available,
Yeah. Yeah, which is something you can do nowadays, given the world of the internet, it's all out there. You can put it all.
And these are 100-year-old editions that are public domain, so we can.
Sure.
And we always give credit to where stuff comes from, but we can use that stuff. How did the tourism part start to develop? Like, how soon was that, and how did that work?
Well, I'm sure I probably know less of it in some ways in Louisiana world than I do in Nova Scotia, because Nova Scotia is connected with. Became connected early on with the rails, with the Evangeline route and so forth.
Right.
So that was part of the business there. But it was specifically, in Nova Scotia, it was definitely perceived as a tourism thing. And, in fact,
mm-hmm.
there were missions actually put out by the Canadian National Railroad of Evangeline to evolve that. It would be interesting to know more intimately how Louisiana worked it out, how St. Martinville, for example, did. Became, obviously, it's connected in
I think Judge Voorhees played a critical role with his true account, quote unquote, the real Evangeline, quote unquote, and how she met Gabriel there for the last time. And, said, sadly, honey, I married. And so she wandered off into the bayou, never to be seen again. But, he...
he rewrote the story with the town as the proper end point instead of some kind of weird middle point for her search. So, and, you know, here's the oak. Let's find an oak that's close to the sidewalk that looks really old and cool, and that's going to be our Evangeline oak. And
that's
then,
right.
Was it Dolores del Rio, Stephen? What was her name?
Yeah.
I
have a friend out in California who's does some occasional writing, and she's we were talking about Dolores del Rio. She says, "Oh my God, she was like a great beauty." And she started talking about my friend is actually Latina, or she's Puerto Rican, and so in the course of talking, I said, wasn't she supposed to be very beautiful? This is when she got started. She said, oh, she was lovely. So we got to looking, you know, we looked up the article about her on Wikipedia, and she was quite strikingly lovely.
Well,
I'm thinking
if you want to see what Dolores del Rio looks like, you need to look no further than the statue of Evangeline by the church in St. Martinville, because when they told her the true story of Evangeline, she was so moved by the story and the oak that she commissioned a statue to be made of her, dressed up as Evangeline.
Because she was the star of the film in 1929.
Right.
Late silent. But if you look, I'm thinking what they're doing basically is creating a site for pilgrimage, right? I mean, it's, you know, you think about the Canterbury Pilgrims of Chaucer, and really he's referencing an actual event that people would undertake yearly to the site of, I guess, of was it maybe where Becket was murdered in the cathedral?
Yeah,
but anyway,
sure.
They would take that pilgrimage. Well, this is essentially what Voorhees and these other people are doing. They're creating a democratic version, small-d democratic version of a pilgrimage site.
I like that, and I've never thought of that before, Stephen.
Yeah,
but
I had when I read it, when you first began to teach it with your students, and I had read a little bit of it as a kid in a book that my parents had, but I'd never read the whole text, and I read the thing, and I thought about people, because, again, I grew up in Baton Rouge, and we went to St. Martinville when I was a kid, and the school took us down there, because that was, you know, a lot of the famous historic sites in Louisiana are down south. I mean, there's some up here like Natchitoches, but a lot of them are down south. So they took us kids to St. Martinville when I was an older kid, probably sixth or seventh grade, and I thought even then about, you know, all these people are gathering here constantly, and then years later as an adult reading, you know, Chaucer and reading other narratives like this where people are going on pilgrimage. So then to bring that up into Bruce adding
Evangeline is in a sense a saint. I mean, she may be fictional.
Yeah.
She's portrayed, you know, like our last guest talked about her, built his book out of the patristics and, you know, basically, you know, how she was a holy figure, you know. So how would you honor that? Well, you don't just make a tourism stop. It's a pilgrimage.
Well, and on top of that, it's okay in America to have a Catholic person of Catholic faith to portray that role, because we're supposed to be, you know, neutral on matters of religion. So we've basically sidestepped or avoided all the religious wars of the 18th century in Europe, and we have this nation where people can practice their faith in, you know, relative peace. And not have to worry about neighbors, you know, coming and attacking them or whatever because they're Catholic or Protestant.
This was necessarily very much the case in 1847 when Evangeline came out because of the Irish potato famine and so forth and the sudden incursion of Roman Catholics in the country.
Right.
And it's surprising in some ways that the poem found that much acceptance in a country which was really not all that keen on Roman Catholics.
Right.
Seems like that
part of the
function of the poem is to say that Catholics can be American too, that we can welcome them, that they can be part of us, and that they will do good things when they get here. And there's this amazing letter. It's a correspondence between the Ursuline nuns and Thomas Jefferson. Immediately following and we actually have the only place that it's legible on the internet. We found a Library of Congress had it all handwritten, and we had this big, like, transcription party, and you know, people standing around staring at a monitor trying to decide if that's an O or an E. But anyway, the upshot is that they're worried the Protestant Americans will come in and take their stuff the way Protestants do. And Thomas Jefferson is writing back and saying, you know, no, we're going to respect your stuff, First Amendment, which was one of his big things anyway. But the thing I wanted to mention was the letter of the governor. Governor Claiborne wrote to his, you know, he was kind of, he got the job by being friends with Thomas Jefferson, right? That's the way he gets it. And he writes and says, these women do
He was another Virginian like Jefferson.
Yeah. These women do good work. They're a benefit to the community. They work with the sick. They teach the kids, the girls. And, you know, we should do everything we can to support them, which seems to be the argument that Longfellow was making as well, that, you know, let them come. They'll do, you know, they do good things.
That's right. They can, yeah. And he idealizes their plantation in America, too, when you think both in Louisiana on the one hand, and then eventually in Philadelphia during the yellow fever epidemic. It's usually thought that that last scene in the last canto of the poem happens in 1793 during the Philadelphia yellow fever epidemic, which would make her about 56, by the way, at the time. Gabriel presumably about that same age when he dies from it. So,
you know, in our day, that's relatively young, but back then that was considered full of years, right?
Yeah, how many more years she lives after Gabriel dies, we don't know. We know there's a tombs, but, you know, we find the two of them are side by side in death, I guess, in the churchyard. But you know, maybe she lives 20 or 30 years after that, who knows? But, I mean, that portion of her quest is ended, I suppose.
Right, right. She, you know, that part of her life is behind her. And she will serve out the rest in service to others. So, yeah, I like that. I'm going to break in here and finish our interview with Ron next week. We appreciate him coming on and dealing with the vicissitudes of a hurricane. I think the first interview we wound up having, the first part of the interview, we wound up postponing the rest of it because we were having so much trouble keeping the phone call going. The phones didn't go down, but they would like sputter, and so would the internet. And it was right after that last big hurricane, and we had not had power for some time, and then by this time the power was on, but it's still not very steady. By the time we got into the interview, you know, I guess after 30 minutes, we break off and then we convene a week later. So we appreciate his patience in dealing with, you know, the way life goes in Louisiana.
Well, and we hope, you know, to go and to kind of go back to what Ron was saying, we hope that this helps to resurrect the reputation of this epic, because it reminds me, and I don't know if I said this in the interview or not, but it reminds me of what happened. I heard this in graduate school when I was studying about Dickens, and he had fallen into, I wouldn't say disrepute by any means, but he'd been kind of cast aside, you know, after his death, I think 1871 or something. It's not long after the American Civil War he dies.
Who is that?
Charles Dickens. But there was a famous biography of him that was released, I think, in 1939 or 40.
Right.
It's what resurrected the man's reputation. Dryden was like that about, I mentioned this on air, he was like that about Chaucer. We owe it to John Dryden for resurrecting the reputation of Chaucer.
Well, and Tolkien brought back Beowulf. You know?
Yeah. So there are famous cases of that in literary history, and I would hope that this kind of thing would do this, say, for Longfellow.
And it bears mentioning for our future listeners that we do have lesson plans, a full unit on evangelism. We're going to be adding this to the resources teachers can use in their, you know, research of it. So we're, you know, hopefully one day we'll have a whole 4-year curriculum of three lesson plans. So you can, you know, or at least what is it? American literature is your junior year in high school.
That sounds right. Yeah.
Yeah, at least a full 1 year curriculum. It's all Louisiana material.
You and I talked about this before about history, and I think it bears kind of applying to literature too. Where they talked about in high school is breaking history. American history, and maybe into a two-year course, like maybe your sophomore, junior year, or junior, senior year. And I'm almost of the belief they should do that for literature, do like maybe 2 years of American Lit and do 2 years of English Lit or something like that, you know?
Yeah, that would be good.
Because we're seeing the same phenomenon or a similar phenomenon right now with African-American writers who might have been, well, like Solomon Northup, who might have sold well in their time and then were kind of cast aside. Now they're being resurrected. So,
well, my son is currently reading Romeo and Juliet, which is standard canon in, you know, Latin and that. But, you know, we have our own version of that, and it's with angels and Gabriel. So get with it, folks. Put these texts to work. Well, for the Lithian Anthology podcast, I am Bruce.
And I'm Steve Payne. We certainly want to thank Ron for stopping in this week and, again, doing such a fine piece of scholarship with his book and really kind of going deeply into the kind of the backstory of Evangeline, and especially, as we point out in the episode, her name, which does, you know, is a feminine form of the word gospel, evangelium. So we want to thank him for going into all of that and for, as I said, kind of illuminating us and hopefully readers of his book about that. Huh?
Of course, literally, the word means good news.
Exactly.
So, it's good news when Evangeline shows up.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So we want to thank him, and we also want to thank all of you for listening in, and we hope that you'll join us for next week's edition of the Louisiana Anthology Podcast. Bye for now.